Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I'm glad to be here, along with my great audio engineer, who is responsible for almost everything. All I have to do is talk, so and all the rest is taken care of. Which is good, because I don't know how to do much else. Okay, so we are in the midst of a what is this, Tip of the Spear special edition? Is that correct? And then one of the things that I keep circling back to is this whole notion, or this whole idea that's permeating up, if that's a proper word, into the mind space of Americans in particular, which is the meta crisis. We're going to be talking about that again, but before we get into that, I got to do some administrative stuff that I sometimes forget to do it. Okay, administratively, we are a radio show on Red State Talk Radio, and we are a podcast on all podcast platforms that we are aware of. And the list goes on and on, iTunes, CastBox, Podbean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we are out there. Long-running show, by the way. We've been around for quite some time, and we sure enjoy doing it. We've got a lot going on my side of the fence here. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But for now, our new book is The Sonic Warrior Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer. Oh, by the way, I meant to mention this to my great audio engineer. I had given the book to some caddy on the golf course, young man, and I do this mostly for the young people. Part of the idea behind the Sonic Warrior is to inspire. These are inspirational stories. They are, in fact, stories. It's not a normal book. It's an unusual book. And so this caddy, young man, said that he appreciated my book, but his dad started to read it. So I was pretty interested in that, and his dad said it's really a great book. So that was a nice feedback, and it was all impromptu. It was quite enjoyable. Okay, what is the name of this show? What are we doing in this show? We're going to be talking about the meta crisis. Why are we going back here? We're circling back to the meta crisis because we need to spend a lot more quality time on it if we're ever going to deal with the issues facing us today in this country. We have to understand what is currently going on. Oh, I got a note from my audio engineer. I need to send people to my website. Is that correct? Yeah. Okay, so if you want to know everything about everything that's going on here in the world of Throttle Up and in the world of the Sonic Warrior Initiative, go to my website, which is thesonicwarrior.com. And that's got everything that you need. Also, it's got information on our Substack. We write a Substack article every week, and it shows up on Substack, getting a lot of attention there as well. So go to my Substack as well, but everything you can go the landing platform here is thesonicwarrior.com. That's the landing platform. We got everything there, and then you go from there. Okay, go to my Substack. If you're not on the mailing list, subscribe to it. By the way, absolutely subscribe to it. And the Sonic Warrior is the place on Substack where my weekly articles are show up. Should have another one out momentarily, probably tomorrow or Saturday. Anyway, so what else? Yeah, the meta crisis. Well, we are in the midst of a meta crisis in this country, and we don't want to sugarcoat it. Right, it is pretty serious, and it's something that we need to deal with, but we can. The whole point of what I tried to do on Throttle Up, as well as the Sonic Warrior Initiative, is to point to the successes that we have achieved in the past. It's more success-oriented show. We can succeed. We can overcome our difficulties. We can respond effectively to our challenges, and we can continue to be the greatest. We can succeed as a country, as a culture, as one nation under God. We can succeed, absolutely. And that's the whole point of what we're trying to put forward here. It's not a dire prediction. We are going to clearly identify what is the problem for which we are seeking a solution. And then we are going to address ourselves to the solution. And it's going to be a comprehensive solution that we are going to be, we are in the midst of proposing. What is the reason why we have or are experiencing a meta crisis right now in this country? We need to understand why this is happening. How is it that this meta crisis has revealed itself as something that is profoundly serious and mission critical? I'm going to have my audio engineer read me the question first, and then we are going to go from there. Here she is.
Hello, Kevin, and hello to your listening audience. Okay, let's see. Now, as you have told everyone, the title of this show is The Meta Crisis and a Revolution of Thought. Now, you are returning to a discussion of the meta crisis that you had a couple of weeks ago, and you are calling for a revolution of thought. Can you explain this for us, please?
Okay, yes, I will. Again, great question from my great audio engineer. And let's first and foremost try to get a grip on the problem. Let's first and foremost work to clearly understand what is the problem. Now, when we look at, and let's go across industries now. Right. Let's look at the industrial base. Let's look at the military-industrial complex, the way we are actually building military systems and fielding military systems, operating them, and updating military systems. Let's look at commercial aviation, and that is forefront in the news. Let's look at airline safety. Let's look at the supply chain issues and the breakdown of the supply chain across many industries. And we begin to see an accumulation of problems that are confronting us right now. And the whole purpose of and the whole point of this Throttle Up radio show and podcast is to address ourselves in a meaningful way to these challenges, to these what we call complex problem solving, or if you like a little bit more about that, it's actually called critical thinking and complex problem solving. That is the I guess that's the definition of what we are all about with respect to this radio show and podcast. So what is it about that we need to understand? First and foremost, we are not very good complex problem solvers. We're just simply not. Why is that? Well, we're not taught. That's not a specific course of instruction. Do you have a PhD or a master's degree or a bachelor's degree in complex problem solving? And the answer is no, I don't. But why not? Why don't you have a degree in complex problem solving if in fact that is what's going on across all of our industries, including General Electric, by the way? If you look at what is, and I was just dumbfounded when I came across this piece of information on General Electric just recently. They are disaggregating themselves. Is that a term? Is that a correct term? Disaggregating. My audio engineer is shaking her head, not sure. General Electric is now divesting itself from non-high-tech industries, and they are becoming once again General Electric Aerospace. They are becoming now not a conglomerate, but a singular entity that deals with aerospace matters. They build engines, by the way. They have been building jet engines for a very long period of time. I know they built, designed and built the J-79 engine, which was used quite extensively in the military back during my era. This was beginning in the 1960s, all through up through the 2000s, probably at least 40 years, the J-79 was in operation. And now they have follow-on, engines from that. They just didn't stop. They built the engine for the large 110,000-pound thrust engine for the stretch version of the Boeing 777. I flew the unstretched version, if that's correct. I flew the original version of the Boeing 777. We had Pratt & Whitney engines for that particular airplane. There was 90,000-pound thrust engines. And they General Electric builds a little bit bigger engine than that, which can power the larger or the stretch Boeing 777. So they are divesting themselves. They're getting back to their core business. Okay, why are they doing that? Well, because they are responding to the meta crisis is the reason for that. And most of these other companies out there, Boeing in particular, is going through serious crises. They are experiencing head-on the meta crisis. They haven't really come up with a very good solution right now. General Electric, I think, is probably leading the pack in terms of trying to find an effective and long-lived solution to the problems. But what is it? What is it about the meta crisis that we need to understand? So let me go through some efforts here to clarify what exactly is a meta crisis. We are in the throes of a meta crisis. I've said that, and I will say that again. We have got to recognize that we are now in this period of time, and it's up to us to deal with it in some kind of fashion in which is effective. A meta crisis, we could say, is a particular state of adverse conditions that have been encountered simultaneously such that the situation is now mission critical. Now, the situation is very complex. the situation is very troublesome, and in many cases, the situation is mission critical. When you have long lead times, when you have extensive delays for our new systems that are being produced or being designed and built, if you have extensive delays because of the breakdown of the supply chain, we are now in the midst of a meta crisis, right? That's just the way it is. And we have to recognize that, and we have to start taking meaningful action. Some organizations are, and some are not. Some are just not doing it. They don't have the capacity or the will, desire to dress themselves in a meaningful way. They just kind of hope it will somehow go away. Now, if, in fact, it is now mission critical, what does that mean? A mission critical situation, and I've talked about this before, comes from a systems safety perspective. In other words, when you say something is mission critical, you're either coming from a system safety perspective, or you're saying that the pathway forward is the only one that is going to accomplish our objectives, and that pathway forward is mission critical. So there's two sides to the mission critical coin. There's one side that says that that this situation, if it is not immediately addressed and fixed or corrected, will become or is already mission critical. And so we have to fix the complex problem. We have to fix it, and we have to fix it now. All right, so this often requires one to, if you're an operator or manager, requires one to bring in the tiger team, all right, that is the elite problem-solving group to solve the problem. On the aircraft carriers that I deployed on when I was a Navy fighter pilot, we had the fire team. The fire team was a group that were the first responders to a fire. Okay, they were the tip of the spear in terms of addressing themselves to a particular mission critical situation. So again, from a mission critical standpoint, which is a system safety standpoint, is that the ongoing operation is being seriously degraded, and chaos and catastrophe are looming large on the horizon, and mission failure is likely. In that situation, which you might call the negative side of it, in that situation, we got to do something now. Immediately, it's got to be fixed, or failure, catastrophic failure, will actually occur. And we've seen this happen. Okay? We've seen this happen across the board. Failure after failure, catastrophic failure after catastrophic failure. I would say if it takes you more than a year to actually redesign a software program that doesn't work in the first place, if it takes you a year to come up with a solution to the design failure that the customer experienced in the first place, if it takes you more than a year to do that, let's say it takes you a year and a half, and you still haven't delivered to the customer a viable system that will function under all kinds of conditions, if you still can't do that after a year and a half of trying, I would say that you have reached the point in which the situation in your organization is, in fact, mission critical, and you better do something about it. and that is the case, I don't see a lot of solutions coming to the forefront. But they will, because there are innovative and creative people out there. I am certain of that. But we have to listen to them. Now, if the pathway, to destruction is clearly laid out in the book, The Logic of Failure, by Dietrich Dorner, why don't we know what that is? So, what exactly is the pathway to destruction? Do we know? Yes, we do. How do we know that? Well, because it's laid out in the book, The Logic of Failure. Now, the book, The Logic of Failure, is not just theoretical. The book, The Logic of Failure, looks at real-time experiments utilizing live human beings in a simulated reality, or in a simulator, if you will, a large-scale dynamic simulator. That happened to be located at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. They were doing, Dietrich Dorner did these experiments, and he discovered the reason why things fail. He discovered the logic of failure. Now, failure occurs first and foremost in a mind space, in the mind, of the operator. Okay, in the mind space of the operator and manager. And before we get into the specifics of that, there is another book, if you will, that has recently come out, and we talked about this by Ian McGilchrist. We talked about this in his book, which is called The Matter with Things. I've talked about this extensively on this show. It is an important breakthrough in our understanding of why things don't work. Why are we now encountering another meta crisis? We've been there before, by the way, many times. We've been there before. One of the key points in our history was the early stages of World War II, when we didn't have enough aircraft carriers in the Pacific. We were facing a meta crisis, and we were also at war. Okay, so we've been there. Now, both Dietrich Dorner and Ian McGilchrist are actually talking about the same thing. We're looking at probably 30 years separating the two, but they both have come across the same set of problems, and they are proposing the same set of solutions. Is that true? Yes, that is actually true. I don't know if there's others that have observed that, but I have. Now, in The Matter with Things, in this book, Ian McGilchrist says that the exclusive focus on the microscopic details of a thing, and this is referred to as reductionism and determinism, will inevitably lead to confusion, chaos, and catastrophe. This is caused by getting a signal from my audio engineer. Oh, yes. Okay. Yep. I got a hustle. This is caused by the complete ignorance of symmetry, harmony, interacting variables, and with respect to complex things, self-organization. Ian McGilchrist says, reductionism and determinism will not provide the proper orientation in which complexity, uncertainty, and interactions can be understood and effectively managed. Reality, in fact, is dynamic, complex, probabilistic, and to a certain extent, uncertain. Dietrich Dorner also points out that in the logic of failure, that at all cost, the oriented mind space that only considers and views reality as the formless collection of data surrounding random events needs to be replaced with a better way to understand reality. Okay, we are going to listen again to this audio clip from Ian McGilchrist. And this is a lecture that he was given at Darwin College. Darwin College is doing a series of lectures on the meta-crisis. And we are going to listen to this again because Ian is making some very important points here that we need to seriously consider as we go forward in our efforts to understand what is it that we need to know about this problem, this complex problem, first and foremost, and then what are the solutions that we need to design and implement as quickly as possible to get out of this looming catastrophic state. Here we go.
Good evening. My name is Ian McGilchrist. I write books about neuroscience and philosophy. The best known two are The Master and His Emissary and The Matter with Things. Today I'm going to be talking about the hemisphere theory as a way of understanding what we call the meta-crisis, the various groups of problems of considerable severity that bedevil us these days. I believe that by understanding more about how the brain works, we can see these disparate elements of the so-called meta-crisis as coherent and in some sense as inevitable consequences of our espousal of a very strange way of thinking about and looking at ourselves and the world to which we belong.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. You join us, of course, for our fourth Darwin College lecture on the theme of revolution. Over the last 3 weeks, we've heard from a historian, a geneticist, and a political theorist, each delivering a rich but varied perspective on the historical, political, and biological revolutions. If you missed any of those, they are, of course, on the Darwin College YouTube channel, along with the lectures that have been delivered, or many of them that have been delivered over the last 39 years. This year, we celebrate our 60th anniversary as the first postgraduate college here at the University of Cambridge. And in the lead up to that, our fellowship have recently adopted a 10-year strategic plan for the college, which both recognizes that the world faces a broad spectrum of interrelated global challenges. We're familiar with many of them. Perhaps you might call them meta-crises, as we will hear more about in due course. And our strategic plan also includes a commitment to act on and promote solutions to such global challenges. And tonight's speaker may well help us on our way in that process. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ian McGilchrist to deliver his lecture. Ian is a psychiatrist, a writer, a former Oxford literary scholar, and after reading English at the University of Oxford, he trained as a medic. He's held numerous distinguished fellowships, academic fellowships, and written many scholarly papers and books, which I'm sure you are familiar with, at least some of you. In his own words, he came late to medicine, but since then, he's served as a consultant psychiatrist, a clinical director, at senior registrar and consultant level in hospitals here in the UK, and as a senior research fellow in the United States. So both he served on the front line and as a scholar in medical science and practice. In addition, he has interests that span philosophy, psychology, literature, neuroscience, and indeed many other disciplines, which together coalesce for him around a deep knowledge, a fascination and understanding in the workings of the brain. And I think he's therefore ideally placed to deliver this lecture on A Revolution in Thought, How Hemispheric Theory Helps Us to Understand the Meta-Crisis. Please join me in welcoming Ian to the stage. Ian.
First of all, I want to thank the Master and Fellows of Darwin College for the honour of asking me to give this lecture. Carved into the stone of the ancient temple of Apollo at Delphi was the injunction to know thyself. Without such knowledge, we are tossed this way and that by forces we neither suspect nor understand. Knowing ourselves helps explain our predicament, and doing so is greatly aided by understanding an aspect of the way in which the brain constructs the world. I believe we've adopted a limited vision of a very particular type, and precisely because it is limited, we cannot see that it is limited. We no longer seem to recognize what it is we do not know, what our way of being in the world is pushing out of our lives and out of our world. To understand what is going on, we need a breadth of view that is increasingly rare. It is the possibility of this that I intend to explore here today. Let me ask you this. Do you think there is a connection between realism, the appreciation of uniqueness, a capacity for understanding melody and harmony, an aptitude for appreciating time, a sense of humor, the ability to read body language, to sustain attention and the fight or flight mode? Or, on the other hand, between a talent for manipulation, a givenness to literalism, to theory at the expense of experience, unreasonable optimism, and a preoccupation with detail, as well as a loss of a sense of the living body, with, in its place, a focus on body parts? Perhaps not. Yet I assure you there is such a connection in either case. It is rooted deep in us, and it is quite coherent once one comes to understand what underlies the pattern. My reason for starting here is to introduce the body of work generated over three decades and published in two long books, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World in 2009, and The Matter with Things, Our Brains, Our Delusions, and the Unmaking of the World in 2021. In these books, I examine critically and in depth the matter of hemisphere difference and its important meaning for our lives. As you can see from the deliberately random selection of respectively right and left hemisphere tendencies above, the distinction is not the simple one that many might have heard and which should be unceremoniously buried. It's not at all the case that the left hemisphere is unemotional and dependable, whereas the right hemisphere is flighty and fanciful. If anything, the contrary is the case. But that a question has been wrongly answered doesn't invalidate the question, but rather should, in my opinion, invite further exploration. Consider these facts. The brain, an organ the power of which consists solely in making connections, is massively divided down the middle. Why? Moreover, it is asymmetrical in almost everything that can be measured at many levels in both its structure and function. Why? Not only that, but the band of fibers that connects the hemisphere at their base, the corpus callosum, is getting proportionately smaller, not larger, over evolution, and is, in any case, to a large extent, inhibitory in function. Again, why? Could it be that two aspects of brain function are being kept apart? Unfortunately, I cannot spend time on the evidence here. For one thing, there is a great deal of it, and it requires to be examined at length. It is laid out for that purpose in the two long books I've mentioned. I'm going to go straight to a characterization of some of the core findings, so please forgive me if these are lacking in finesse. To some extent, that is inevitable for present purposes, as I'm sure you will understand. In a nutshell, each hemisphere has evolved for classical Darwinian reasons to pay a different kind of attention to the world. When I saw this, I have to admit that the full import of the distinction did not immediately dawn on me, because I'd been trained in a cognitive science paradigm that saw attention as simply another cognitive function. But the nature of the attention we pay is of critical importance. It creates and molds the only world we can know. Indeed, it is a matter of a disposing of our consciousness towards the world in a particular way. The left hemisphere has evolved to pay narrow beam attention, focused on a detail that we already know and desire, and are intent on grabbing and getting, whether it be something to eat or to use in some other way. In a word, the left hemisphere exists in the service of manipulation. The right hemisphere, meanwhile, is on the lookout for everything else that's going on while we're manipulating, for mates, conspecifics, offspring, and predators, so as not to be eaten while eating. Its attention is broad, sustained, coherent, vigilant, and uncommitted as to what it may find, the exact opposite of that of the left hemisphere. In brief, the right hemisphere is in the service of understanding the contextual whole, which is nothing less than the world. And context changes everything. The difference, then, is not, as used to be supposed, to do with what each hemisphere does, as though it were some sort of a machine, so much as the manner in which it does it, as though it were part of a person. The hemispheric difference in attention is beyond dispute. Indeed, it is universally attested. And since the nature of attention also indisputably changes what it is that comes to our attention, such a difference logically cannot but lead to two different phenomenological worlds. Hence my belief that attention is a moral act. It helps form both us and the world we come to know. So what are these two worlds like? Very briefly, if crudely, these worlds could be characterized like this. In the case of the left hemisphere, the world is simplified in the service of manipulation. It is made of isolated, static things. Things, moreover, that are already known, familiar, predetermined, and fixed. They're fragments that are importantly devoid of context, disembodied, and meaningless, abstract, generic, quantifiable, fungible, mechanical, ultimately bloodless and lifeless. This is indeed not so much a world as a representation of a world, which means a world that's actually no longer present, but reconstructed after the fact. And it is literally two-dimensional, schematic, and theoretical. Not, in fact, a world at all, more like a map. Nothing wrong with a map, of course, unless you mistake it for the world. And here, the future is a fantasy that remains under our control. The left hemisphere is unreasonably optimistic and fails to see the dangers that loom. In the case of the right hemisphere, by contrast, there is a world of flowing processes, not isolated things. One where nothing is simply fixed, entirely certain, exhaustively known, or fully predictable, but always changing and ultimately interconnected with everything else. Where context is everything, where what exists are wholes, of which what we call the parts are an artifact of our way of attending, where what really matters is implicit, a world of uniqueness, one where quality is more important than quantity, a world that is essentially animate. Here the future is a product of realism, not denial. This is a world that is fully present, rich and complex, a world of experience which calls for understanding, not the map at all, but the world that is mapped. The emotional timbre here is more cautious and, in general, more realistic. We need both of these worlds to work together, but also independently, hence the need for connection and separation. Naturally, we are not aware of this because these worlds are combined at a level below our awareness. We become aware only after an accident of nature, such as a stroke, tumour, or injury, or after commissurotomy, the so-called split brain operation, or if one hemisphere at a time is experimentally suppressed. Then they may become suddenly, vividly present to us. Yet because these two worlds have mutually incompatible properties, when we come to reflect self-consciously and to rationalize about what we find, we're forced by the requirement for consistency to choose between the pictures of the world they offer. This is why, as A.N. Whitehead, one of my intellectual heroes, observed, a culture is in its finest flower before it begins to analyze itself. Once our lives become very largely mediated by self-reflexive language and discourse, as in our postmodern world they are, the explicit stands forward and the implicit retires. Yet almost everything that really matters to us, the beauty of nature, poetry, music, art, narrative, drama, myth, ritual, sex, love, the sense of the sacred, must remain implicit if we're not to destroy their nature. The attempt to make the implicit explicit radically alters its nature. We can no longer rely on the wisdom that comes from these all-important but hidden sources, from closeness to the long tradition of a society, to nature and to the sacred, to sophisticate our understanding. In fact, we see these not as irreplaceable guides to truths deeper than those that science can encompass, but as lies. Possibly entertaining lies, but lies nonetheless. We begin to see only the self-created, self-referring world according to the left hemisphere. We go for the machine model, reductive materialism, and the consequences are all around us. Unfortunately, the two hemispheres are not equally veridical. In terms of our ability to apprehend, take hold of, and use the world, the left hemisphere is superior. But in terms of the ability to comprehend the world, the right hemisphere is superior. In each of what one might call the portals of understanding, attention, perception, judgment, emotional and social intelligence, cognitive intelligence, that is IQ, and creativity, the right hemisphere is so much superior that the left hemisphere on its own has been repeatedly described as frankly delusional. This is not a rhetorical expression. Denial of the facts and delusional beliefs are far commoner in association with damage to the right hemisphere and consequently dependence on the left hemisphere than the reverse. On its own, the left hemisphere confabulates, makes up stories so to fit with its beliefs. It will frankly insist that a paralyzed limb is unaffected, or if challenged, deny that the offending appendage belongs to the subject at all. Belongs to you, doctor. Unlike the right hemisphere, which sees more than one angle and has for this reason been called by V.S. Ramachandran, the devil's advocate, the left hemisphere never doubts that it is right. It is never wrong and never at fault. Someone else is always to blame. Furthermore, in what I take to be the four important onward paths to truth, science, reason, intuition, and imagination, though both hemispheres contribute, the crucial part in each case, including in science and reason, is played by the right hemisphere, not the left. Our predicament is that we now live in a world where the understanding of which is largely limited to that of the inferior left hemisphere. Some signs of this include our inability to see the broader picture, both in space and in time, the way in which wisdom has been lost, understanding reduced to mere knowledge, and knowledge replaced by information, tokens, representations, the loss of the concepts of skill and judgment, which are the products of experience, the divorce of mind and matter, resulting in a strong tendency to simultaneous abstraction, and the debasement of matter to mere lumpen matter, therefore our exploitation, an exponential growth of bureaucracy and administration, everywhere the proceduralization of life, the reduction of justice to mere equality, a loss of the sense of the uniqueness of all things, the supplanting of quality by quantity, the abandonment of nuance in favor of simplistic either-or positions, the loss of reasonableness, which is replaced by rationalization, a complete disregard for common sense, the design of systems not for humans but to maximize utility, a growth of paranoia and pervasive mistrust. For if all is not under its control, the left hemisphere becomes anxious and projects its anxiety outwards onto others. Nonetheless, we play the passive victim and abjure responsibility for our own lives. In addition, I might point to the rise of anger and aggression in the public sphere, the destruction of social cohesion and its replacement by angry warring factions. Like almost everything that used to be said about hemisphere differences, the idea that the left hemisphere is unemotional is wrong. The most highly lateralized emotion is anger. And guess what? It lateralizes to the left hemisphere.
Okay, so we are getting close to the end of another show. I need to spend a few more minutes here to kind of summarize where I would like to go with this information. And let me point out a couple of things here before we leave. We have control over it. There's an aspect that I would like to propose. And that is cognitive intent. What is our intent? If we get up in the morning, do we turn on our thinkers and just let them operate randomly, or do we organize our thoughts, or do we focus, or do we desire to do something? And what is our intent? How do we intend to use our brains? How do we intend to use our minds? How do we intend to use our consciousness? Now, Ian McGilchrist is talking about attention. Attention. What is it that we are attending to? If we are attending to, first of all, if our minds are chaotic, they are completely disorganized, we need to do something about it. And one of the things that is happening right now in certain key areas of, let's say, the higher education, the arena in which colleges and universities reside, there are some thought leaders there that are looking at how do we organize our minds and how do we take charge of our attention. First and foremost is we do not get up and immediately go to our digital devices. we put them on the shelf or we lock them away for at least an hour before we begin to use them. We spend the first hour of our waking day thinking about certain things, wondering and looking at it in with respect to the opportunities, the rich opportunities that we have to gain wisdom. Ian also talked about the portals of understanding and what emerges from that. What emerges from that is truth. If we utilize our faculties, if we utilize our assets in terms of acquiring understanding of the real world, what and understanding of the truth. How do we know what the truth is? We try to figure things out and what is actually true through the portals of understanding, and we examine what is coming in once we have selected the areas in which we intend to pay attention to. What's coming in to us is things that are related to objective science, objective reasoning, intuition, and imagination. And through that process, we begin to gain some wisdom about what is actually going on. Remember that, now he talked about the right flow, and I'm just talking about what is it that we are doing with our brains, with our consciousness. Are we considering things like flow, like processes, like the change, like the interconnecting things or the items within our reality that are interconnected? And my audio engineer is telling me I need to wrap up because I'm getting to the end of another show. Is that correct? Yes. Yes. All right. All right. Another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And we will see you all next week.